Welcome back to Canna Week, brought to you by New Frontier Data, where we deliver the week's top headlines in cannabis and hear experts weigh in on the impacts these stories are having on the industry. I'm your host, Heather Wickline. Our first guest has an impressive history working in the pharmaceutical sector with Johnson & Johnson and various health and beauty businesses. His background in healthcare led to his career in cannabis as a longtime advocate for its medical applications. He serves as Managing Director of Europe at Materia. Please welcome Vic Materis. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And our next guest is a pioneering thought leader in the cannabis industry and also leads up our research team here at New Frontier Data. Please welcome back our Chief Financial Officer, Mr. John Caggia.
Yeah, it's great to be back, Heather. Thank you.
It's always good to have you. So, Nick, before we jump in, I'd love to, if you wouldn't mind giving our listeners who may not be familiar with Materia a quick overview of who you are and what you do.
Yeah, happily. So Materia is a medical cannabis producer and distributor. So we have a pan-European footprint, which is really anchored in our cornerstone asset, a production facility in Malta. And just to be clear, we don't cultivate. So by production, what we really mean is packaging, extraction, and formulation. So we use Malta as our hub for that. And then we distribute into major markets across Europe. Obviously, the main one being Germany. We have an asset there that's licensed to import and distribute to pharmacies and is doing that today. And that's really kind of the genesis. The entire project is really the genesis of a number of us who worked in the Canadian cannabis industry for quite a while. And when we saw the European market's pace of growth and some of the similarities between its nature and that of Canada's, we thought there were a lot of lessons that we could apply to a European-focused cannabis business. And so that's kind of how the Materia project started almost 2 years ago. We also do have a presence in the UK that's more focused on non-prescription CBD. And instead of doing our own manufacturing for that, what we really do there, the core competency, is about acting as a sales and marketing engine for brands, getting distribution and raising consumer awareness and generating consumer demand for sales into the UK.
Fantastic. Well, there's definitely lots of lessons to be learned from the Canadian market. All right. Well, we have lots to cover, so let's dive right in. Last week, BBC reported NHS cannabis guidelines challenged in court. Medical cannabis in the UK has been a bit of an anomaly. After being legalized in 2018, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence has basically said there's not enough evidence proving the effectiveness of cannabis-based medicines, and evidence for its safety is limited. This has basically led to almost no cannabis medications being prescribed since legalization, and this proposed challenge to the NHS's stance on medicinal cannabis could lead to a big shift in acceptance among the medical community and open up access to cannabis as a viable form of treatment. Nick, I would love to start with you. How have the recommendations from the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence impacted the trajectory of the UK's medical cannabis market?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the way that the recommendations impacted the trajectory is that they effectively stopped there from ever being a trajectory. There was a huge amount of excitement when the law was changed back in 2018 after, I think, what can only really be described as a public outcry at the confiscation of cannabis medicine from two young children who had severe epilepsy. That caused a review of the medical cannabis law, and the pace of that review, and again, the public support fostering or driving the government viewpoint shift was really encouraging for those of us who believe in medical access. But since the law came into place on November 1st of 2018, there's been only a few hundred prescriptions actually issued. So it's really stunted what were initially high expectations for patient access and a really robust market. And I think there are a few different reasons for that, but you make the right point about the primary driver being NICE's recommendations. Effectively, NICE acts as a body that advises physicians on how they should think about and how they should treat patients with regards to different forms of treatment or medicine. And none of the products that we know as unlicensed medicines, so when we think about dried flower, for example, or extracts, you know, tinctures, basic oils, tinctures that you find like in the Canadian market, for instance, NICE basically said that they do not recommend they're being prescribed for anything under any condition. They did say that CBD, for example, could be recommended for chronic pain, but only as part of a clinical trial. And so otherwise, you don't really have any any physicians who are willing to prescribe unless they are going to be defying NICE's guidelines and recommendations. So it's been a really difficult start for the medical market here in Europe, here in the UK, just because the body came out with such an unfavorable view on whether cannabis should be prescribed as a medicine.
Yeah, I mean, this article in particular really pulls on your heartstrings, especially whenever there's children involved. I mean, there's a three-year-old boy that's obviously suffering and he has no other alternative. Nothing else has worked for him except for this. And you would think that anybody would want to do anything to help a child suffering, which is just really, really heartbreaking. John, what do you think about this?
Well, a couple of things. One, you know, I think it really underscores and affirms how little education there is amongst healthcare practitioners, amongst the physician community, about the kind of opportunity potential and applications for medical cannabis. You know, the majority of medical schools still don't have formal training around cannabis as a therapeutic alternative. And so you tend to find kind of a deep skepticism amongst practitioners, particularly amongst older practitioners, about the utility that medical cannabis could represent in improving patient wellness. You know, this is also a study of contrasts between the model by which medical cannabis was legalized in the US. And one of the things we heard so often from patients in the US, particularly early on, was that, you know, the physicians, their doctors would give them recommendations for some pharmaceuticals. They would themselves experiment with medical cannabis. The doctor would see the results or just kind of this dramatic shift in the patient's well-being. And that's how the doctor would then get engaged with medical cannabis, because they'd seen almost the before and after contrast in their own patient's experience. In the UK's case, where you don't have access to kind of this non-kind of formally regulated or non-state regulated medical cannabis, where you know, it's being the choke point is the recommendations being made by NICE, the ability for doctors or for patients to go out and get it themselves, the jeopardy is much higher for them if they're using it in an unregulated way. And so, you know, it becomes a much slower process in terms of persuading physicians that there's opportunity here, changing the regulatory apparatus to accommodate medical cannabis, and really getting this into the hands of patients to enable physicians to see firsthand how striking some of the benefits can be to some of the patients who use medical cannabis.
The one thing I'll add to that as well, it's important to understand about the UK framework is, unlike many other countries, such as Germany, the framework doesn't actually allow for any general physician or general practitioner to prescribe cannabis in the UK. It's only those on the specialist register, which is about a quarter of all physicians in the UK. So right there, that's a huge narrowing of the corridor through which a patient can actually access cannabis. And so that's in addition to the NICE recommendations. You actually have to find a specialist rather than just speaking to your GP about medical cannabis as a form of treatment.
So contrast that, Nick, with the German model. Like, who can recommend cannabis under the German model, and how does kind of patient access look in that market?
Yeah, great. It's a great contrast just because how fast Germany has grown. So Germany implemented their law about a year and a half before the UK. It's actually not that great amount of time ahead of it. Any general physician or general practitioner in Germany can prescribe medical cannabis at their discretion. And so there's no qualifying conditions. It's just that they do have to subscribe to or have to commit to reporting back to the BfArM, which is the German Medicines Agency, effectively, or a regulator, as to how the patient has responded to that treatment. But in terms of using their discretion to prescribe, they have the full medical discretion afforded to them by the framework. And that's why Germany's prescription numbers are so high in the, you know, hundreds of thousands now, as opposed to in the UK, where we've cumulatively got less than 1,000 in almost 2 years.
That's amazing. That's incredible, the difference. Would you say, just as far as, you know, the inability to advertise products, do you think that has had an effect on the public perception of medical cannabis?
Probably not, because it never existed. So it wasn't something that was taken away. Obviously, if you were allowed to advertise, you could probably pull at the emotional heartstrings of the public and push the public sentiment farther along faster. As we've seen some countries broadly allow, you know, some states have tried, some companies in the states have tried to do that. You know, we probably remember the infamous Super Bowl ad that was rejected, but that got a lot of media attention regardless. So on the prohibition of advertising medical camps in the UK, I don't think it has had a negative effect because it never existed. But you do have public sentiment developing anecdotally. Right now, there is a pretty broad acceptance of cannabis's therapeutic benefits amongst the public in the UK, and I would say Europe at large, but it's through basically anecdotal conversation and just general, slow, gradual acceptance, as opposed to companies going out and beating their drum, for instance.
Yeah, and I actually think the US in this case is probably a pretty good model for seeing how there's this almost social contagion effect in terms of acceptance and awareness of medical cannabis. Because broadly speaking, even in the US, advertising restrictions were pretty stringent, particularly relatively early on. It's not like you were seeing a lot of television advertising, billboard advertising, particularly in the early stages of the market. Where I think some of the biggest catalysts of changes, I think, were the kind of concept of cannabis being a kitchen table issue. So even for people who weren't following the market closely, who weren't cannabis consumers, once it hit close to home, a friend, a coworker, a loved one, being afflicted with a condition which they started using cannabis and saw benefit, then that became a major catalyst for public opinion. And I think that's part of the reason why you've seen public opinions shift so much faster than legal access. So even people in states where cannabis remains illegal in all of its forms, you see support for medical cannabis specifically at, you know, close to over 90%. You know, people have had enough kind of social contact with medical cannabis, you know, whether it's in 1 or 2 degrees of separation, and that I think has been a much more potent driver than candidly anything that the marketers or advertisers could have done. You know, it's easy to oppose medical cannabis, but when, you know, grandma's using it for her arthritis, a loved one is using it to alleviate their cancer, a child is using it for epilepsy, I think the emotional resonance of that and the catalytic effect that has on public perception is far more profound than even the most effective marketers could have had.
Yeah, I think that humanizing element is definitely something that's always going to help the story of cannabis and its effect, because you're pulling at the human heartstrings of people who are just seeing an improved quality of life. John, what's it like in states like, for example, Utah, where, you know, for me, that was such an interesting state to allow for medical access, given how, you know, you think of the social fabric of a state like Utah. But how do they talk about medical cannabis publicly? And do companies actually come out and talk about products in a way that kind of straddles, you know, the lines of making medical claims and really trying to push forward a narrative that will also convince the naysayers?
So Utah, I think, is a really interesting example of how quickly the pendulum has swung, and how some of these institutions that have been drugs to legalization are being kind of dragged along, kicking and screaming. So you may recall that the Mormon Church, which is arguably the most influential institution in Utah, had come out against medical cannabis in the state. And there was such an uproar amongst the congregants that they realized that this thing is going to pass whether we want it to or not. And so the church backtracked and said, all right, let's take part in this conversation and play a role in shaping the regulations, rather than kind of trying to take our ball and going home and having this thing pulled out of the station without us on board. So one, just as a study of kind of this social wildfire that's raging, and these large institutions that have largely been conservative and opposed to the expansion of legalization are being forced to come along because they're realizing that their ability to influence or slow the trajectory of this is limited. Now, specifically to kind of the marketing and advertising rules. So on the marketing side, you know, I think a lot of brands are still being fairly regimented and compliant with the rules around making medical claims that would run afoul of the FDA, et cetera. However, where I think there's a really robust conversation happening is at the dispensary level with the bud tenders, who are in many ways not bound by the same sort of restrictions as one might be if you were running a television ad, running some web ads. And I think that's where the conversation is really happening, where consumers are able to go really deep and, you know, can this be used for patient for condition X, Y, or Z? The bud tender education piece, I think, has been a critical catalyst. And then secondly, the social networks, the social communities being built around medical cannabis are also helping kind of traverse or cross that bridge, which the brands aren't able to get to. So when a patient is able to say, I use product X, Y, or Z for my Crohn's disease, for my arthritis, that serves as a really effective kind of an ambassadorial or apostolic kind of message in a way that the brands may not be able to, or would not even be legally allowed to communicate themselves. So the restrictions are still in place, and I think brands are increasingly disciplined about it, because this is not a season where you want the feds knocking on your door for anything. But even within that rigid advertising framework, between the bud tenders or in dispensary conversations, coupled with online communities, there's a really robust line or discussion happening that's drawing that line between condition and specific condition and specific product to apply toward it.
Mm. Nice. Well, before we move on, just one final comment on this article. There's this industry. Nick, what do you think as far as what the UK medical industry can do to remain a viable player outside of just like completely the reversal of these recommendations and guidelines? Is there anything they can do to remain in the game?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know how many people would take the position that they're in the game at the moment. But in terms of trying to become competitive, the first thing is that I think the UK needs to be more open about taking data from other countries. So in the UK, you hear at all levels of government and amongst the medical sphere that they need to see RCTs, randomized controlled trials. Which is the pharma model. You know, you need your double-blind placebo-controlled trials to demonstrate that a product is safe, but also has efficacy for a certain indication. The problem is you're not going to get that with, you know, plant material like dried cannabis flower. And so what I'd love to see the UK government do is just be more open to the data that we're collecting in Germany, in Canada, in Australia, where you can really speak to it's real world evidence. It's not clinical evidence, but that is a form of data that has a lot of validity and shouldn't be ignored. That's kind of probably the first pillar of change that I'd like to see. The second is there is, to John's point earlier, very limited medical education at the moment. Doctors need to help educate doctors on the results that their patients are seeing. At the moment, that's not happening broadly. And again, back to my point around only letting specialists prescribe, it's a huge bottleneck for patients who want to have access. So that would be the second thing. And the third and last one is probably around the commercial structure of the UK landscape right now. It makes products extremely costly for patients and with inconsistent supply. Right now, unlike in Germany, most of it's more than 90% of all prescriptions are actually paid for privately. So the NHS, the public health service here in the UK, has basically not covered any cannabis prescriptions. And so the patients who are paying for them often are racking up bills of hundreds of pounds a month, which for many of these families are really unaffordable, and they're having to make serious sacrifices. And that's down to a few things. One, the fact that it's extremely costly to import. Up until recently, actually, you could only import on a patient-by-patient basis. That was changed so that as of about March, you can now import 25 doses at a time. But even that is extremely minimal. So it's very costly for producers or distributors to bring product into the country. Those costs obviously get passed on to the patients, unfortunately. And as a result of that as well, it's also because it's hard to import and overly complex, you don't see consistent supply coming into the country too because of the costs. And because frankly, it's a lot more effective to, if you're going to allocate your inventory to certain markets, you'll allocate it to Germany over the UK any day because you can get it in more easily and you know that the market's growing faster. So there needs to be more done to support the markets as well, because frankly, unfortunately, companies are making financial decisions. So I would say those are kind of the three things that I'd like to see change. There's an openness to new evidence, an ability or a greater drive on medical education, especially from medical professionals to other medical professionals. And then lastly, that the piece around a little bit more commercial friendliness so that we as an industry can actually support the patients in the way that we desire to without having to, ascend these extremely high economic barriers that the framework currently erects in front of us.
Absolutely. I think in that article, the family said that they were paying between £1,000 to £3,000 a month right now to treat their child, which is astronomical. I mean, that's absurd.
Yeah, you hear stories. They're heart-wrenching stories about families having to choose between their kids' health and effectively their homes. And that's happening up and down the country at the moment. So it's really unfortunate that we haven't done more, where the 2018 government review, the conclusion was cannabis has medical benefits and we should enable medical access for patients. And yet what actually came to life as a result of that, what was birthed, was so restrictive that it actually completely undermined that conclusion. So it's an unfortunate contradiction in the exercise that was done versus the outcome. And we just hope and keep pushing for change.
Well, hopefully articles like these will help push them in the right direction and open their eyes a little bit. Okay, well, moving on. The Telegraph had reported battle for legal cannabis lights up as lobbyists make economic case. So while the medical market is facing its own institutional hurdles, the push for full adult use legalization seems to be gaining more steam. More trade associations, think tanks, and some government officials beginning to advocate for increased access to cannabis. And the UK seems to be more open than ever to substantial cannabis reform laws. So Nick, how has the economic contraction, spurred by the pandemic impacted the debate around legalization?
Yeah, so I must be honest, I haven't seen a great deal of conversation around this at the government level. Of course, I think every industry has used the economic contraction caused by COVID to champion for an expansion of their particular industries. Cannabis is no different. And I hope not to be a parrot of negativity, but we haven't seen any government respond, any government official respond to that in any serious way. So the article that you mentioned and several others, of course, tout the economic benefits of legalization. And you see the standard or customary arguments troped out around criminal justice as well and taking the tax dollars away from them too. But the reality is, if you think about the practicality of going from zero to legalization, and I will say the UK is pretty much at zero today, you're talking about a 2 to 3 year timeline at minimum for implementation. And if you look at the steps that Canada took after Justin Trudeau was elected in 2015, it was a year for the task force to come up with their report on recommendations on how cannabis should be implemented, legalization should be implemented. That was a year. It was probably another one or two for the bill to go through all the parliamentary procedures and get finalized. And then you can estimate probably another 6 to 12 months for implementation. So you're talking easily 2 to 3 years for an idea to actually turn into the very first steps of an industry being birthed. And I feel like people who make the argument around the economic benefits probably haven't thought through just how long it actually takes. We wouldn't be seeing or realizing the economic benefits for years, unfortunately. While we'd love to see it, it's just not a short-term upside that we would see materialize.
John, would you agree with that?
I would. I absolutely agree about the long arc between the initial proposal for legalization and the activation of a regulated market. And I actually think that tends to be one of the areas in which stakeholders who are trying to pursue opportunities in this space just don't plan appropriately and don't take that fully into account. It's a long, drawn out, legally complex process. So that kind of change doesn't happen overnight. But we actually think there may be a more nuanced opportunity for cannabis and medical cannabis specifically, is as we think about the toll that COVID has taken on healthcare systems globally, particularly in largely public funded healthcare systems. You know, the cost of kind of healthcare delivery at a point where you have such acute numbers of people who are falling ill, who are being serviced by the system, has meant that cost containment is going to be a major consideration, a major debate for the next couple of years. And the longer this pandemic promulgates, I think the more acute that conversation is going to become. And so maybe just kind of taking a step back from the idea of full legalization, where by and large, particularly more conservative countries, that's going to be a long meandering debate. I think there's more immediate conversation to be had about what role can medical cannabis play in all of its varied forms in helping alleviate the acute stresses on healthcare systems. And, you know, are there kind of ready levers that can be pulled without going the full route of full legalization that can help, you know, both improve patient outcomes while reducing the cost of healthcare delivery? I think that's going to be a much easier conversation to have than saying we're going to go from full prohibition to full legalization. And I think that's also going to be an issue that is much more resonant because we're at a point where, at least in the US, we're talking about hospitals on the verge of declaring bankruptcy because they can't manage the costs associated with this pandemic. There's, you know, some patients who are walking out of the hospital after a COVID treatment, $150,000 to $200,000 in debt. And so the alternatives to effective healthcare delivery, I think, creates a window to include cannabis as part of the pharmacopoeia in a way that there might not have been the appetite to have that conversation pre-pandemic.
Hmm. And John, have you guys, you or the team, seen anything around the economic impact of swapping in cannabis in place of another prescription medication? I mean, we obviously have all seen the substitutability of those, or at least how you know, generally the amount of medications on which a patient is dependent is reduced when they introduce cannabis into their treatment program. Of course, in the US, you don't have a fully national public health system. So it's a bit of I'm asking for a jurisdiction that maybe isn't quite analogous to that which we have here in Europe. But I ask because in Germany, for example, the size of the cannabis market actually has been growing so fast and has become already so costly for the national health provider that they introduced a new pharmacy pricing scheme earlier this year, which effectively reduced how much reimbursement they would offer to pharmacies. And the reason was because they were recognizing this was costing them far too much. There wasn't anything said, at least publicly, around what that would cost them with regards to the full holistic view on bringing down the cost of other medicines that the patient was leaning into less or relying on less because of cannabis. But I'm interested to know if you guys have seen anything akin to that, that Europe would be interested in anywhere across the US. I know in Canada we haven't seen anything, but keen to see if you've seen anything south of the border.
So we're actually working to and we'll be refreshing likely later this year, or early next year, a study that we did a couple of years ago, looking at that potential substitution impact. You're right, we don't have a national healthcare system, but in one of the part of the analysis that we did was looking at it in the context of substitution within the Medicare program. So the Medicare being the closest equivalent we have to a national healthcare model. And there, if I recall correctly, we were looking at about $25 billion in cost savings per annum on the top four or five conditions for which drugs are being prescribed within Medicare. So the cost transference there would have been pretty substantial. And when you look at a dollar per dollar basis between, say, an opioid and a dose of cannabis, whatever form that's being delivered in, at least in the US medical market model, where you still have flour being used, you have concentrates and other kind of low-tech processed forms of the product, the cost differential to the patient is fairly dramatic, even when the patient is incurring that cost out of pocket. But I think that there's a second and perhaps equally important part of this discussion or debate, which is around the attendant effects of pharmaceuticals, particularly when you look at things like opioids and dependency. So when a state like Illinois changes their law to say that if your physician prescribes you an opioid, you automatically become eligible to sign up for the medical cannabis program. Yeah. It's you know, in recognition of twofold. One, you know, there's a cost element there, but the scale of the kind of social and economic impact of the opioid epidemic in the state has become so acute that whatever the cost of medical cannabis might be, it is going to be far lower than the total cost of not just prescribing the opioid, but also the attendant effects of dependency, of drug rehabilitation, and the social disruptions caused by dependence. So I think there's a much bigger kind of umbrella under which, or there's a much bigger base of associated costs related to pharmaceuticals that may actually not be accounted for when you're doing this one-to-one comparison between what's the cost of a prescription drug versus the cost of a cannabis dose.
Definitely. There's a qualitative element to that as well. What I've always really admired about those ORT, the opioid replacement therapy programs across the US, is the fact that they also acknowledge, beyond just an economic consideration, the fact that many patients who are prescribed an opioid, their condition actually doesn't require an analgesic of that potency. And of course, the addiction risk profile of that opioid is so much more hazardous than cannabis itself. So it does more, obviously, than just the economic impact. It actually, I think in many patients' cases, kind of better maps the product that's being prescribed to them, or the medicines being prescribed to them, to fit the severity and the nature of their actual condition. So I've actually always loved, every time I see a state implement an ORT program, I think New York was the last one that did it in a big way that I was super proud about. I would love to see that kind of thing be done all over the world. It's just a very, very meritorious idea.
Now, quick question for you, and sorry, Heather, I have to ask this.
No, don't. Love it.
The cost basis for medical cannabis in Germany, why is it so expensive? First, expensive to the patient. Now, is this an economies of scale issue where, you know, because it's a mature market, the quantities being brought in means the price per dose is high? And then two, kind of, why is it so expensive to the government? Love to hear your perspective on that.
Yeah, I mean, the market is 2.5 years old, or 3.5 years old. March of 2017 was when the law changed. And obviously, it's still at a place where there's a great imbalance between supply and demand. So that allows producers to charge high prices. Of course, the prices are coming down quite fast in Germany, based on the fact that there's been an introduction of new products and new players. Up until now, the majority of prescriptions were fulfilled, for flour specifically, were fulfilled by a single producer, which was Bedrocan in the Netherlands. And so there wasn't really a great, any differentiation between those products. And so the Bedrocan, which was basically the majority of flour prescriptions, effectively became a price-driven sales cycle. And so that's kind of why. So that's why you're starting to see the average price points start to drop. But historically, the reason it was so high was simply because of a demand supply imbalance and producers charging what they could. To the second part of your question about why is it so high to the government, for that reason, basically the way cannabis is scheduled in Germany is considered a medicine and a narcotic. By virtue of being a medicine, the legislation mandated that it must be covered under public health insurance. And therefore, there was really no say in it. Only, like I mentioned earlier this year, did the government step in and say, this is actually starting to cost us quite a lot. So we have to introduce a new pharmacy pricing scheme that basically minimizes the amount of markup a pharmacy can take because this is starting to cause a more sizable dent into our healthcare budget than we anticipated. And actually, the common sentiment is that there will probably be a revision of that further reduction next year as well. Again, the government is just looking at it and going how fast this is growing and what is our liability going to be over the next few years as this continues to accelerate.
Awesome. Well, we are almost out of time. So before we say goodbye, any final thoughts for our listeners, Nick?
No, it was just a pleasure to be on the show. And I hope that, you know, for anyone listening, that we continue to kind of lobby for patient access. Fundamentally, that's kind of why we're all here. And to be patient about it as well. We hear stories about how medical cannabis changes patients' lives, and it really does drive waking up every day and working the long hours that we do. But it's also important to remember that we're asking the world to take a mind shift, a pendulum swinging from one end where cannabis has been stigmatized as a dangerous drug to not just being accepted, but actually being beneficial. And so you're really asking people to undo a lot of their thinking. And I just hope the conversations like this and all the work that the great work that I know New Frontier are doing push that that initiative forward.
Awesome. John, any last thoughts for you?
Yeah, I think I would just echo a point that Nick made earlier, which is that while we understand the conservatism that is influencing decision-making in countries like the UK and countries around the world, it would be unfortunate if everyone insisted on trying to reinvent the wheel rather than taking the lessons being learned by truly professionally run operations and operators and healthcare providers and governments globally. The impact on patient wellness or the opportunity to positively impact patient wellness, I think, is great enough that rather than spending the next decade investigating and doing the studies or the work that has already been done, whether it's in Israel and Germany and Canada and the US, taking a truly global and collaborative approach to helping educate, inform, and raise awareness. Because you know the science, there's enough science to affirm positive thinking and affirm that medical cannabis does improve patient outcomes across a spectrum of conditions. I think rather than redoing all of that work, we should be standing on the shoulders of giants and building forward from there.
Awesome. Well, thank you both so much for joining us today, and thank you for our listeners for joining us at CannaWeek. Please be sure to like and subscribe to the podcast. You can find these new stories and more on New Frontier Data's Cannabis Insights Daily. I'm your host, Heather Wickline, and we will see you next time.
New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.